A new report shows public hospitals have just three-quarters of the specialists they need, with particular shortages in oncology, psychiatry and neurology. The Senior Doctors Union, the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists, says the shortage means thousands of New Zealanders are missing out on treatment. Meanwhile, overworked senior doctors are facing burnout and stress, with no time to teach and mentor junior doctors. Sarah Dalton, the Executive Director of the Association, says the data comes from DHBs and the situation hasn't really changed in 5 years.
We've basically brought together a lot of existing research, some of our own and quite a lot of other people's, just to look at the state of New Zealand's medical workforce pipeline. Obviously, our members are senior doctors and dentists, mostly working in hospitals. And I guess the key thing is it's our contention that we have about a 24% shortage nationwide of hospital specialist doctors and dentists.
Is that based on unfilled vacancies, on appropriate staffing ratios? How have you reached it?
It's a mix of all those things, but we surveyed clinical directors and clinical leads of from every DHB over the last several years. And so based on their data to us and our ongoing findings when we do a thing we call service sizing or job sizing, where we go in and help the doctors in a service determine whether they think current staffing is sufficient for current need. So based on those things, it hasn't really shifted since we started doing these surveys in 2015-16. We completed them last year. And there's other data that tells us that, you know, there are gaps. Sometimes it's because of international shortages in a particular specialty. It can be really hard to recruit. Sometimes it's that the hospital is pretty strapped for cash and they're not willing or able to approve new FTE or new positions. It can be a whole range of things.
Is some of it being driven by population growth as well?
That's certainly, yes it is, but also acute demand is actually rising at a quicker rate than population growth at the moment. And although I think the Ministry will say there has been some increases in medical staffing over the last few years, they have not been at the same rate as acute demand.
Why is acute demand rising?
Well, that's a really good question and probably someone better qualified than me to answer. But, you know, people are living longer. We have got a boom in chronic disease, some of which are diseases of poverty. We've also got, we think, significant unmet need. And, you know, the longer people go untreated for what might be something straightforward, the more likely it is to become something acute and complex, much more expensive to treat, much more difficult to treat.
Which specialties are most exposed?
I think leading the charge is radiation oncology, but there are, I think, about half of the specialties listed by vocational scope are sitting kind of at that extreme end of need. So there are lots. You know, we've got national shortages in mental health, so we need more psychiatrists, and we're also heavily reliant in psychiatry on overseas-trained doctors. We've got gaps in oncology. We've even got, you know, we've got physicians saying that they can't recruit to all of the people they need. So it's very broad. And, of course, we all know that public health, you know, when COVID hit, they were really, really undercooked and have been for some time. So it's a real concern.
What is the impact of the shortage?
I guess the big ticket item for us at the moment in terms of, you know, we're a union, we're concerned for our members' well-being, it's fatigue and burnout, you know. And we've got all these people who went into medicine for good reasons and who love the work of being a doctor, but the work is killing them, you know. The largest age group in our membership at the moment is the 50 to 55-year-olds, and they're starting to get tired, you know.
Is the workforce overall ageing?
It is an ageing workforce. And so, again, the people we're training aren't keeping pace. So a significant number of our members, when we asked them a couple of years ago, said they were planning on retiring or leaving medicine in the next 5 years. Time is a ticking. There are still a number of people looking to leave. And we don't have great pathways for doctors as they hit their late 50s, early 60s. For some services where they have quite a small call roster, a limited pool of people to call upon. It's very hard for doctors to come off after hours on call. So, you know, work at night, if you're a shift worker or if you're having to respond to call, is really fatiguing, and there aren't great recovery provisions in place for senior doctors. We do have a clause to say there has to be recovery provisions, but pick up on that is patchy. So lack of recovery time is hard. Doctors are tired, there's higher clinical demand, and of course it doesn't leave as much time for teaching. And, you know, the training model we have for getting to be a senior doctor, it's very much an apprenticeship model once those junior doctors hit the hospitals, and it requires there to be enough senior doctors and with enough time to support quality teaching.
Is this affecting patient service?
We think that it is. Our members do everything that they can to make sure patients get the best care they possibly can. But, you know, the Medical Council some time ago issued guidelines about how to care for people appropriately in resource-constrained contexts. And we know there are waiting lists. And we reckon unmet need, people who aren't even on a list, not even being seen, could be upwards of 400 or 500,000.
The heavy dependence on overseas trained doctors goes back a long way. What's the current dependence?
We're sitting at around about 42% of our senior medical workforce. That's the second highest in the OECD. Figures suggest that about 28% of those overseas trained doctors will leave New Zealand within 5 years. Of course, we have lots who stay, and they're fantastic. But the churn of those overseas trained doctors is understandably higher than it is for locally trained doctors.
What impact is COVID going to have?
Well, the jury's out on that. Some services are saying they're getting increased interest from overseas trained doctors again, who see New Zealand as a kind of better place to be practicing medicine and one that isn't completely overwhelmed with COVID. So you never know, we may have an influx and that may help us in the short term. But we think that the longer term solution is to grow more of our own doctors for all of the obvious reasons, I suppose.
What is happening with workforce planning? There's been, you know, entire task forces that have been set to work on this some years ago now. And more broadly across the whole health system, it should be said. But what has happened with workforce planning initiatives?
I think that's a really good question. So, as you know, Workforce New Zealand was disbanded a couple of years ago, and the workforce responsibility brought back within the Ministry of Health. They have just landed a report commissioned by Martin. They commissioned Martin Jenkins to do a bit of a health workforce funding report that just came out this month. I think what it means is they have been doing some sort of new foundational work, and now, of course, we have the Simpson Review about to roll out, so there's quite a bit of uncertainty about what the leadership from the centre will look like. But it's our contention that we need to effectively have a medical workforce census and a health workforce census and some very clearly communicated information about current data, planning, projected need, and what that's going to require of us all. A very common response when we talk to DHBs about this is, oh, we need to look at the models of care. And that's all very well, but if you're still short of enough health workers to do the work, it doesn't really matter what the model is. People are still going to miss out.
So are they talking about who does what and where within the health system and that they need to look at that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we would note, you know, the way they term it in health is scopes of practice. So, you know, specialists work within a particular scope, the things that they're really good at and are qualified to do. So do nurses. So do allied health workers. So it's a matter of working out, you know, who is in the best position and the most appropriate person to do the various tasks in what are called multidisciplinary teams. And that's fine, you know, that's really good. But if everybody is being asked to work at the top of their scope of practice to do the most difficult and taxing stuff all of the time, that is also very fatiguing. People need to have variety and they need to have some work that isn't the most difficult work that they can possibly do.
You mentioned how long it takes to train specialists and also how that happens. Does that need to be looked at? Is it possible to improve on it from a logistical perspective, or would that come at the cost of quality?
I don't see why it would come at the cost of quality, but there are a lot of players in the game in terms of training junior doctors, and there was a real sense of frustration, I think, that came through in the Simpson report. You could almost hear Heather Simpson's voice sort of reflecting on the difficulty in finding out where the ownership lay for that pathway from university all the way through to completed advanced training for junior doctors. You know, there's colleges, there's employers, there's universities, there's the medical council, and some of the colleges are Australasian, so it's not just a matter of local rules and regs, it's what the Australians are doing as well. So it would, I think it would be really helpful if we could have a bit more clarity and a bit more leadership across that. So we think there's room for a bit more transparency around what's going on.
Are you seeing enough medical practitioners coming through the system with a desire to go on and become specialists to meet future need?
That's a really interesting question, and we don't have, you know, that's the sort of thing that really begs some great qualitative data, and we have got quite a bit of that from our own members who are senior doctors. We currently don't have as much from the junior doctors, and I think that would be a really useful conversation to have. What we do know is very early on, people who are determined they're going to be a surgeon may emerge several years later surprised to be a GP or a public health physician or a pathologist, and there's a lot of factors, some of them quite subjective along the way. It could be that they have a brilliant experience, you know, in a particular training run that makes them change their mind. Sometimes people make decisions based on whole-of-life reasons, and what we think is more and more junior doctors coming through, and more of our own members who are senior doctors and dentists, they want a bit more flexibility, and they would like to have a little bit more time to spend with their families. You know, the reason that junior doctors are often referred to as resident doctors is because back in the day, they lived in the hospitals, and that was pretty much their lives, and you know, that's not really a model for this day and age.
How confident are you, especially with the size of reform coming that you've just alluded to, that this long-running issue is going to get addressed in a systematic way?
I might put a bottle of wine on it, Catherine, but I'm not super confident. You know, one of the reasons for our conference is to try and get lots of the parties in the room and be part of a better conversation about where to next. I think the Simpson Review gives us, there's clearly an intention from government to give the whole system a bit of a shake-up, maybe a bit of a Marie Kondo declutter, I don't know. Andrew Little has already said, you know, $20 billion goes into health every year. He's really keen to make sure he knows where it's landing and that we're getting best use from that amount of money. And that's fair enough. But the bulk of our health system is actually workforce. You know, something like 70 or 80% of operational costs for hospitals is staff. Obviously, a very small proportion of that is senior doctors. But I think we can do better. Yeah, we need to do better.
You also alluded to something else. Is there more and more work landing the way of hospital-level care and acute-level care than there used to be and than there needs to be? And if so, what is driving that?
That is a definite yes. We are being told in certain parts of the country that people are presenting in EDs because they can't get a GP appointment or they can't for some other reason access a GP. It might be cost, it might be that they can't get time off work or whatever it is. We also know that the social determinants of health, you know, camp housing, poverty, other factors like that, very low incomes, people are more prone to, you know, the diseases of poverty and those things. You know, we're seeing chronic diabetes, we're seeing rheumatic fever, we're seeing TB, we're seeing syphilis. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that we shouldn't be seeing in our country, and the roots of those things are well outside of the health system.
That is Sarah Dalton, Executive Director of the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists. They've released a new report in which they argue public hospitals have just three quarters of the specialists that they need, with particular shortages in oncology, psychiatry and neurology. The National Conference gets underway today.